my coaching philosophy was a little bit different than a lot of people's in the fact that, you know, I believe that your best player should get most of the shots. And some people say, well, that's selfish or that's not team ball. But it sure was because, you know, it even took more teamwork because you had to have those people that were willing not to be high scorers that could get the assists and make the passes and play defense. And I had a tremendous group of kids like that that didn't get mentioned much, but they were why we were successful.
Darrell Walters, fantastic coach in North Central Kansas. Coaches Week continues here today. We'll talk to the former Osmond Girls head basketball coach coming up here in a little while on the Sports Ticket. We got some local news, some breaking news, and this is interesting what's taking place because earlier this week we had Ken Piazza on Tuesday. Beloit wrestling coach, of course, back in the early 80s, even before that, won four straight state championships, Kansas Wrestling Hall of Famer. So there was going to be a flavor of Beloit Trojans. That same morning, Dallas Cox took a job in Concordia. And so thus, we had a breaking news story involving a Beloit coach going to coach somewhere else. And we were featuring a Beloit coach on Coaches Week. Are you with me?
Yes.
Today, we are focusing on an Osborne coach, Darrell Walters, for Coaches Week. And the breaking news comes from?
Osborne.
Yeah. Yes. Doug Ubelaker is retiring. He retired at the USD 392 board meeting on Monday. He's retired after 33 years being the Osborne High School Athletic Director. He thanks everyone for all the time, and he very nice email he sent out to some folks. And he thanks everyone, and he'll continue to teach, coach track, and officiate next year. So Doug Ubelaker, Athletic Director for 33 years at Osborne, is no longer going to be the AD there, retiring from that position, but he still will teach, coach track, and officiate next year. So we'll still see him around and everything else. Ever since I've been here, and actually way back when I went to school at Watkinney, he would have been, 33 years would mean that my whole high school career, he was AD at Osborne as well.
Yeah.
I don't want to make Doug feel old if he's listening right now, but that's pretty interesting. So we thank Doug for his service as athletic director, and athletic director has a lot more behind it. Trust me, you talk to athletic director, you find out what they have to deal with, especially schedules. That's just sometimes a nightmare with postponements and whatever else, but many other things they have to deal with too. And so there'll be a new athletic director at Osborne, and we'll try to get a hold of Mr. Ubelaker, Doug, and see if we can do something with that in sports later on either today or tomorrow. So congrats on Doug retiring from that position, maybe a little less stress, and he can focus on teaching, coaching, track, and officiating.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's a lot of time to spend serving your school, and I know that he stepped up and has done that for quite some time, and I know it makes a lot of other people's jobs easier when somebody will take that job
right
and take care of that for you.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Very
congrats
cool.
Congrats to Doug on a great career.
So, Beloit was a focus on Tuesday, little do we know, and now Osborne Thursday. So tomorrow, Keith Grissine, former head coach at St. John's Tipton Wakanda East, apparently there'll be breaking news coming out of St. John's tomorrow that we're just not quite aware of the way things have been going. If you missed our interviews with Steve Tiernan, Osborne head football coach, Don Melby, former Pike Valley head coach, Ken Piazza, former Beloit wrestling coach, all those interviews are posted at our podcast page. Go to katiecountry94.com, click on the podcast tab, and click on the Sports Ticket, and you can find the interviews or play-by-play replays that we've had over the last month or so as well at your convenience. All right, Senior Spotlight, Dusty.
Yeah, we're going to
break. If it was an Osborne Senior Spotlight, we would have it all covered, but no, Dusty had to go in a different direction.
We're going to break Osborne up with a little Sylvan Lucas here on our Senior Spotlight today from NCCastSports.com and Cunningham Telephone and Cable, and Bo Bashman and Kelsey Decker from Sylvan Lucas, the seniors there. Bashman participated in three sports during his high school career. His senior year, excelled on the football field, helped lead the Mustangs to a 6-4 record, and led the team in rushing, first team All-District 5 running back. He was also the defensive MVP of that district and a first-team All-District linebacker, honorable mention All-State on the gridiron as well. Then on the basketball court, a key contributor to a team that went 18-7, won a sub-state runner-up, honorable mention All-NPL pick, averaging 7 points, 5.5 rebounds, 2 assists, and shooting 43% from the floor for the Mustangs. Also had some success on the track during his career as a junior. He finished 10th place at the state meet in the 1A 300-meter hurdles. Also, Kelsey Decker, a solid senior season, both in volleyball and basketball. Honorable mention, all-NPL volleyball selection. Led the Lady Mustangs as a setter with 260 assists and also added 37 aces, which was second on the team. 187 digs, 34 kills, 19 total blocks. Sylvan Lucas finished 19-14 on the volleyball court. In basketball, the Lady Mustangs went 13-8 in 2019-20, and Decker averaged 3.5 points and 2 rebounds. touchdowns a game on the hardwood for Sylvan Lucas and Coach Craig Batchman's team. So congratulations on great careers there for Bo Batchman and Kelsey Decker, our senior athlete spotlight on NCKSSports.com from Sylvan Lucas High School here today.
All right, congratulations to them. And once again, read about that, ncksports.com. Well, unless you're playing miniature golf, using a putter on every hole seems like really silly, doesn't it? But a 60-year-old Golf Week amateur tour golfer, Anthony Griggs, accomplished the feat during a recent event. He turned in an 84 to capture the D flight during a recent event at Whirlwind Golf Club in Chandler, Arizona. You want to guess what club he used on all 18 holes? It was a putter. Well, I got to let you guess because I realized I let the cat out of the bag earlier. So a putter on 18 holes. That's right. He used it to drive. He used it to chip. He used it in the fairway. He used his putter. And he shot an 84 on an 18-hole golf course. I'm going to tell you something. When I shot 84, I was happy.
Yeah.
And that's with all the clubs in my bag. So that's pretty impressive. 60-year-old guy doing that. Won his flight by using just a putter.
Yeah.
So what would you like to use on this shot? What's the point of a caddy in that situation? What do you want to use here? You know, just forget the bag and just carry the putter, which I'm guessing that's what the caddy did. They probably didn't carry a bag around. Why would you? You know?
Yeah.
Unless they carry it. The caddy had the bottle of water in one hand and then like a granola bar in his back pocket, and then he had a putter.
Yeah.
It's like, that's all you need. Dude, you're 60. I know you're 60. You can still carry your own putter. What the heck? Why am I here? Pretty interesting stuff. Michael Jordan, The Last Dance, we talk about that every Monday because that's right after they have the shows. The last two episodes are this Sunday. What are we going to do without this series? Man, they could go on for months and I'd keep watching. There's no doubt about it. I know Dusty would too. But there are certain things that aren't going to be in this docuseries. I saw my good friend from Kansas City last night. And if you read the Jordan rules, if you read some other things about Michael Jordan, you're going to realize there's a lot of things that aren't in this thing. And I remember Michael Jordan was the one that finally consented to having this released. He was concerned about things that would make him look really bad, that he might look like a tyrant. He even said that in the last episode about, hey, so people see him as a tyrant, but you didn't win anything, blah, blah, blah. But here's the thing. Michael Jordan, that thing wouldn't have been approved if Jordan didn't have a say in it, obviously. And so there are certain things that don't make the cut for The Last Dance. And here's one of those. Sam Smith, who wrote the Jordan rules, he has mentioned a few times, and he mentioned again the other day, that Michael Jordan would deprive his teammate Horace Grant of food after bad games. Horace Grant would not be allowed to eat on the plane. He'd tell the stewardess, he had a bad game, don't feed him. He doesn't deserve to eat. That's what Jordan did to Horace Grant. Now, no players went on the record to saying that at that time or anything else, and they said, you should write that. And Sam Smith said, well, you should, if I can quote you. And they're like, oh, God, no, we can't.
Yeah.
So apparently Jordan deprived teammates, got on him for being overweight and everything else. Kobe did the same thing with Shaq, called him fat and lazy, which in a way he was. Yeah. So, and if you think that's bad, Jordan did a lot of other things behind the scenes that aren't going to make the cut of this Last Dance. And yeah. Some people are going to say, well, that's a great leader, blah, blah, blah. A lot of people would say that's a bully. So it depends on how you look at it. Here's the bottom line, though. He did care about his teammates. He just pushed them so hard. He wanted to win so badly. He's the ultimate competitor. But people, if they would hear some of these other stories that aren't quite in the docuseries, you would go, I did not know that. Interesting, yeah. That was left out. I do have to give Jordan credit. There has been some stuff that's in this thing that I would have thought he might not have allowed. So I will give him some of that credit, but there's obviously stuff that he nixed, and I would guess this was one of those things. I would imagine.
Yeah.
And it would explain Horace Grant, there has been a little animosity between him and Jordan a little bit. And Pippen and Jordan aren't super tight, per se, since, they quit playing together, so forth and so on. A lot of talk about the Bulls would have won a whole bunch of championships if they would have kept the team together. Well, Pippen would have been a free agent, and Jordan, I think, was going to retire anyway after 98 because he was burnt out again. So it's interesting how people point different things and want to blame Jerry Krause for everything. He's not in the docuseries in regards to a lot of comments other than their negative comments for the most part. So he's shared in an undelightful light. And there are many other things that aren't in the docuseries that you like to have. But then again, you only have 10 hours.
Yes.
You got to pick together what you're going to put together for the docuseries, The Last Dance. Major League Baseball, the DH, it looks like, expected to be approved by Major League Baseball and the Players Association for both leagues, just for 2020, but I got a feeling it's going to stay forever. The DH, now, you know who's really mad about this, don't you? Who would possibly be mad about a DH in both leagues? What would be a type of player? Somebody we both know.
Pitchers that like, want to hit.
Who's a good
Zach
hitter?
Greinke.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah.
Madison Bumgarner. Yeah. Those two guys got to not like this at all because they love hitting.
Yep.
In fact, I saw something about Zach Greinke's OPS in 2010 was better than Bryce Harper's. I mean, wow, you know. So they're expected to prove this. It'll be universal DH in both leagues. Now, yesterday we talked about this on our show, about the battle between the owners and the players. And many times the owners are going to win the battle of public opinion. It's just the way it is. Players come across as greedy, even though the owners have billions of dollars, and players, some, may have millions of dollars. Blake Snell is a 27-year-old pitcher of the Tampa Bay Rays. He's a very good pitcher. In fact, didn't he win the Cy Young a few years back? Or was I think he did win the Cy Young.
I think he won it, yeah.
He had an unbelievable year. Blake Snell's 27. Here's Blake Snell on whether or not he's going to play this season with reduced pay. Listen to this very closely, and you make your own opinion on what you think of this.
Y'all got to understand, man, for me to take a pay cut is not happening because the risk is through the roof. It's a shorter season, less pay. Like, bro, I got to get my money. I'm not playing unless I get mine, okay? And that's just the way it is for me. Like, I'm sorry if you guys think differently, but the risk is way the hell higher and the amount of money I'm making is way lower. Why would I think about doing that? Like, you know, I'm sorry. So in my head, I'm preparing for next season and I'm actually preparing for right now, but as if I'm preparing for next season. Like, it's super weird, man. But guys, I'm just saying, man, it just doesn't make sense for me to lose all of that money and then go play and then be on lockdown, not around my family, not around the people I love, and get paid way the hell less, and then the risk of injury runs every time I step on the field. So it's just not worth it. It's not. I love baseball to death. It's just not worth it.
Okay. Your thoughts?
Listen, I get where he's coming from. I understand it. How do you think
that comment comes across? That whole 1 minute.
It's pretty selfish.
Bingo.
Yeah. And like I said,
wonder why players lose the court of public opinion?
Yeah.
That's why, right there.
Yeah. And, you know, I think he makes some good points in there for sure.
Right.
But that is why they come across like that as selfish. And then and in the back of your mind, you're like, well, if you don't play at all this year, how are you going to get paid? How are you going to get yours? Because that's what he's talking about. He needs to get his.
Right. Well, you're not going to get anything.
If you don't play at all, you're not getting anything.
Right.
So you're going to give up a whole year based on that principle. That part doesn't make sense to me. But
well,
I get what
he's
saying.
He's giving up half a year.
On a safety and
he's
stuff
giving
like
up
that.
Half a year.
Well,
he's not giving up a year. He's giving up half a year. The proposal is 81, 82 games. So he's not giving up a year. Half of it's going to be gone anyway.
Yeah.
So is it a lot?
But by the end of it, I mean, it's for, I know, across the board, it'd be everybody's given up at least half. But,
Yeah. Let me give you a little background, Blake Snell. He's 27. He signed a 5-year, $50 million contract with the Tampa Bay Rays, including a $3 million signing bonus, and all $50 million of his contract is guaranteed. His average salary will be $10 million, and in 2020 this year, he will earn a salary of $7 million. Of course, he's saying, obviously, that's all broken down. I didn't play the whole 2-minute cut, but he also talks about taxes coming out of it. I'm like, hello, dude. Welcome to America.
Yeah.
So just to give you an idea.
Do anything about that.
It's so interesting. We talked about this on the show yesterday, that the court of public opinion almost always sways towards supporting the billionaire owners instead of the millionaire or $250,000 paid Major League Baseball player. This is a great example, just less than 24 hours later after we talked about it, of how fans feel about players. The owners don't come out and say these type of things typically. And that's smart on their part. The less they talk, the better publicly. You get players in front of cameras, or in this situation, the players can stay away from it completely because of COVID-19. And here's a guy on Twitch, Blake Snell, going out and saying, I'm not going to play. And I understand his concerns about, I'm putting myself at risk, I could get the Rona, so forth and so on. I get that part. But when you complain about how much you're not going to make money and I need to get mine and this and that, dude, you have a $50 million guaranteed contract. Guaranteed means guaranteed.
Yeah.
You already got $3 million in the bank on a signing bonus, not to even count the other money you made before you got your big deal. Blake Snell is doing just fine. So what do you think the responses to Blake Snell on Twitter are like?
Probably not very positive for Blake Snell.
Exactly. how about this? I'll just give you a few of the replies. Luke says, Blake Snell should tell risking his life part to people who work at grocery stores. Do I miss baseball? Do I want to see them back on the field? Heck yeah. Do the players have a right to not take a pay cut and risk themselves being exposed? Yes. No need to rush anything back to the sake of money, but unfortunately, that's what the world revolves around. What's another one here? Kevin, wow, that's a really bad look. Callie, I miss baseball way less than I did 3 minutes ago. Weird how that works. Risking his life, laugh out loud, is what Mike says. PJ has a good point. He goes, damn, brother, I'm a huge fan, but I have to risk my life every day just to pay the bills, and I know I'm just a dirty lawn guy, but dang, I want everyone to get paid, but take a step back, bro, and listen to yourself. Toadie, he doesn't have to work. We do. It makes the decision a little easier. So he can, you know, he's set. He's okay. If he don't work this year, you know, he talks about he's got to get his, but if he's going to give up partial money now, obviously he doesn't need it that bad.
That's what I'm saying.
Exactly.
It doesn't make any sense, right. That part of it.
Right. Kyle says, perfect. Major League Baseball will start without you. You can sit out and file for unemployment. See you next year. Blake Snell complained about taxes? Are you kidding me? Played in Florida nonetheless. Virgil, okay, I work in a grocery store for $10 an hour, interact with around 100 people a day, but go ahead, you complain about your money. Let's see, what else we got here? I feel so bad for this guy, risking his life on the baseball field, taking a pay cut, only making $3 million this year to pitch once every 5 days. This is just debilitating. Can we set up a GoFundMe for him? People should not be treated this unfairly. Do you hear the sarcasm there at all? Let's see here. What else we got here? What else we got? If they actually felt this way, they wouldn't want to play. They want to play just not for reduced salaries. There are some people that are supporting it. He's saying what lots of ball players are saying behind closed doors. These guys have families. Some have wives and kids. The wives also have a voice in the decision. Difficult decision to ponder with the potential to catch a life-altering disease. This one says, so out of touch. A grocery store worker makes a year what he makes a game and is exposed to countless more people than he would be. Blake should be more worried about taking a line drive to the dome than getting COVID-19. Interesting point. And so forth and so on. All of these tweets, and I could take an hour and read them, because there's 350 replies, but I would say 90% of them are negative after Blake Snell said that stuff. Yeah. And like, I agree with you. He makes good points. I mean, you know, I'm putting myself at risk on the field. The owners are not. I got to be at lockdown. I'm going to stay away from my family, this and that. Also, they're going to be treated so well, though, on the flip side of that. Yeah. Not like grocery worker, and not that the grocery workers are treated badly, but you know, a lot of people in the front lines aren't going to be treated anything like these guys are. And somebody pointed this out the other day. If there's a lack of testing in our country in certain areas, how can we justify testing players every single day? That's what they're talking about in our proposal, is that the players are going to be tested like basically almost every single day. Wouldn't those tests be better off for people that can't afford or can't get to or access testing? That's an excellent point as well. So it all comes back down to, as always, in sports, money.
Oh, yeah.
Money.
Absolutely.
And the players say, why am I going to take a bigger risk with my life in regards to COVID-19 or getting sick or putting my family at harm's way or not spending time with my family to play a sport that I love? But at the same time, I'm supposed to take a big pay cut to do that. You can take the side you want to take on, the owners or the players. I see both sides. I truly do. I understand owners. It's a business. If we run our business here, it's pretty simple. If revenue goes down, if revenue goes down, we're not spending as much. That's what every business owner will pretty much do. If their revenue is severely down, they're going to cut back, right? That's human nature. Well, that's what the owners are doing. The only difference is they're billionaires. So they can swallow that money. And is it fair for somebody to say, well, they're billionaires, so what's so many millions of dollars? They'll be fine. Well, maybe they earned that money, so they don't want to lose it that quickly. They have a right to that. They own the team. It's a business. They're going to run it like a business. Some people don't get that aspect. From the player standpoint, a lot of people think they're just flat-out greedy. But if you're a player making minimum salary and then you have a family member that has a weaker immune system, so forth and so on, aren't you very concerned?
Yeah.
Because you're not going to get a prorated amount of that minimum salary on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand it. And what we don't hear from are like older coaches or managers or umpires about this. What do they think about all this? Because to me, they're more at risk than Blake Snell.
Yeah. That's what I want to hear from those guys. Yeah. And I also want to hear from the guy that you were just talking about, the guy that's making the minimum salary.
Yeah.
Because I don't feel sorry for Blake Snell. He's already made plenty of money.
I don't either.
He's already made part of that front end of his contract.
If you worried so much about money, then you should play for the prorated amount because you need the money. But obviously he doesn't need the money, but he's complaining about the lack of money. And, bro, I want mine. Well, you come across very selfish when you say
that. Yeah. You can't, in the same comments, say you want yours and then say you're going to sit out and not take any of
exactly.
it for this year.
It contradicts a little bit, doesn't it?
What?
Doesn't. Not a good look. Not a good look at all. One last thing, and then we'll get to Daryl Walters on our Coaches Week. This was put out there by my friend Dallas. I thought it was very interesting. Most unbreakable record in professional sports. What's the first one that comes to your mind? Most unbreakable record in professional sports, not college.
Yeah, you tagged me this morning on Twitter, and that's the same one, the first one that comes to my mind is the 56 game
by Joe DiMaggio.
By Joe DiMaggio.
The closest anybody's been is Pete Rose at 44. That's the closest.
Yeah.
And that still means you're half a season, half a month away.
Yeah.
Whit Merrifield had a 30 game hitting streak, and he's barely halfway there.
Yeah.
That means you got to get hit for a full month. I don't see anybody ever getting a 56.
No.
At all. Any others you can think of?
I did well, and I already saw some different people answering, so I kind of wanted something different. See if I
sure.
I found one that's not going to be broken, and it's going to sound weird coming from me, but Wayne Gretzky's points record in the NHL will never be broken. It's 28-57. Jaromír Jágr's the closest at 19-21.
Yeah, it won't happen.
Yeah, nobody's ever going to break that one.
I'll give you some others that people have put out there. Ripken's 2,632 straight games.
Yeah.
I would agree. In today's age where load management and everything else, more than likely that's right. Wilt's 100-point game. I'll tell you that is more possible than a lot of these. John put that out there, and I agree with John. That seems like it can't be done, but Kobe at 81.
Yeah.
Devin Booker at 70. Now, I know that's still a ways away, but the NBA is all about offense now. And if a guy gets really, really hot, what a great story would be with the NBA if somebody scored 100 points. I think a lot of teams will make sure he don't score 100 points. So, that'd be embarrassing to give up 100 points. So, I'm with John. I think that's a tough one that's never going to be met again. But I think that's a little bit more doable. It sounds weird to say than 2,632 straight games or a 56-game hitting streak.
Yeah.
Here's one I think is completely not doable. 511 career wins as a pitcher by Cy Young.
No.
That ain't happening.
No.
That's done. That's over. Unless the sport really changes or they say, hey, you pitch one inning, you get a win, even if you're a starter. That's about the only way that happens.
Yeah.
What are some other ones here? Doug put Jerry Rice. When I first saw that, I'm like, Jerry Rice had an unbelievable career, but football's all about throwing the ball and catches and yards. But, you know, when you start thinking about it, according to his numbers, which I didn't double-check here, but in order for people to break Jerry Rice's record of catches and yards and touchdowns in his career, a player would have to average 103 catches, 1,500 yards, and 13 touchdowns for 15 years in a row. That ain't happening probably either.
No, it's not.
And
he's actually one that comes to mind, too, but I wanted something different, you know?
Right, exactly. What else we got here? Back-to-back no-hitters by Johnny Muir. That's an interesting one. Isner Mahout's 11-hour tennis match. Will that ever be? I mean, it's possible.
That could be. You know, they still, you know, places that are still playing that much.
But less likely now because a lot of these majors now don't have the keep on going forever. Well, they're going to tiebreakers.
Yeah. Wimbledon's the only
right.
Might be the
and
only
aren't they
one
changing right? Wimbledon? I think they were changing
theirs.
They might
be changing Wimbledon.
They're changing it at like 12-12 or something or whatever it was. So that would mean that would stand. Eric Gagne's 84 consecutive saves. That still was amazing he did that in the modern era. Rocky Marciano's 49-0 record in boxing. Now, I think that can be matched. I think if a guy does it right, but I think it's still very hard. If baseball doesn't change, Ricky Henderson's 1,406 stolen bases will never be touched.
No.
I mean, it used to be that you led the league in stolen bases, you had to get to 100. Now you get to 40, you might win it.
Yeah.
Because everybody's looking for the long ball. Favre's 321 consecutive games as starting quarterback. Yeah, I think that's a tough one to break, although I think that one is possible. Somewhat possible. You mentioned Gretzky's 2,857 career goals. That's a good one. Here's one that I think will never be matched. UCLA winning 88 consecutive games, but that's not a pro.
Yeah,
that's
you said pro because if you wouldn't have said pro, that's on the top of my list of
and
other
Connecticut
ones that
women's thing, they'd be the only one that could break their own record.
Yeah.
And I would go 14 straight conference titles by KU. I don't think it's going to be broken ever again either. Yeah, so there's a lot of different ones that are out there that people can say. A lot of the ones I think about are baseball. You know, Nolan Ryan's career strikeouts, yeah, that's probably not going to be matched again
career
either.
Career no-hitters.
Career no-hitters. And the reason, exactly. You know why those won't be reached? Because of pitch limit.
Yeah.
You know, guy has this no-hitter we see now in the 7th, 8th inning. They don't want to protect their arms.
Yeah.
So guys aren't going to be allowed. And in regards to innings pitched and strikeouts, players don't complete games as much as they used to because of pitch limits or worrying about wear and tear, and it becomes a specialist game with a 7th inning guy, 8th inning guy, 9th inning guy. So a lot of the pitching records in baseball, I don't think will ever be matched. But I will say this, Verlander's got a couple no-hitters, and he's been close to 3 or 4 others. He isn't that far away from matching Nolan Ryan 7. But there's a guy that's pitched for, what, 16, 17 years.
Yeah, and so, he's back in now.
Yeah, he's the back end of his career. Yeah. So there's a lot of different ones that you can say. But there's no doubt about it that, you know, 511 wins as a pitcher, I mean, for crying out loud, you'd have to pitch 25 years and win 20 a year, and you still would be 11 short. That ain't happening, man.
No.
Unless the rules change on how you determine who gets a win as a pitcher. That's not happening. I put it out there on Twitter as well. You can follow me on Twitter, NCKS Radio Guy 10, and you can share your idea for the most unbreakable record in professional sports. I have some people mentioning this. Derek Thomas, 7 sacks in 1 game against Seattle. Yeah, that would be tougher to do now, I think, but I think that's doable. We see guys still get 3 or 4 in a game, but that's an interesting one to bring up. What else we got here? Bo says 511 career wins. Adam says 100 points in a game with Chamberlain. So I think they're all going to be pretty close to unbreakable.
Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt.
Just don't see a lot of it anymore either. What records are breakable? That's the next thing. Like, what ones are breakable?
Well, how about an NFL team going undefeated and win the Super Bowl?
Yeah.
We were close once, but is that going to ever happen?
Yeah.
The Dolphins
doesn't
undefeated
look like it.
Super Bowl.
Yeah.
That may be, you know, the Warriors going 73-9. I think it sounds weird to say that's unbreakable because it happened recently, but, I mean, for crying out loud, dude, you know how hard that is?
Yeah.
Now, they didn't win it all, of course, but there's another one that might be broken.
I don't know if they can do 74-8.
That's insane. What you'd have to do.
Yeah.
So lots of records out there that are probably pretty unbreakable that we could come up with. And if you want to share yours, you can put that out there to us. All right, Dusty, who are we going to talk about today, or who are we going to talk with today on our coaches?
Yeah,
longtime
Osborne girls basketball coach Darryl Walters took his team to multiple trips to the state tournament and a couple state championships as well. And we'll get his thoughts on his career as a coach and some of the highlights during that time. And he's got a lot of good stories to tell. Darryl Walters, former Osborne girls basketball coach with us. Hope you enjoy it this morning here on the Sports Ticket. And welcome back here on Katy Country 94 on the Sports Ticket, katycountry94.com as well. And we're pleased to be joined by one of the legendary coaches of high school basketball here in North Central Kansas, Darryl Walters, who won a lot of games and had a lot of great players there at Osborne, especially with the Lady Bulldogs there for a time. First of all, thanks for taking a little time to join us. Coach, how you holding up? How's everything going for you?
Just doing pretty good, Dusty. I'm, in retirement. I retired in 2004 from teaching, so I've been blessed by guys having some health and have had a good retirement. I did coach up till 2007, girls, and it was always my desire to. When we had those good girls, a lot of people would say, well, anybody could coach them, which they probably could have, but I decided I wanted to hang in there a little longer coaching, so. And see if I could get a team back to state. And so then when we did 2007 again, I said, that's enough, and we'll leave it for the younger people, by golly. But I'm retirement's good to me, and I've been blessed with pretty good health. And of course, this corona deal is everybody's struggling with a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate you guys trying to keep the sports going on your network radio station, because there just isn't much sports stuff going on without you guys making an extra effort.
We enjoy it. We've had a lot of fun, you know, playing some of the older games and going back and talking with some of the coaches. Hey, you're kind of an interesting case because you've been in it a long time. You've gone through a lot throughout your career. And I know you graduated from Portis, right, and had some success there at high school in Portis,
1960,
right?
1960, Dusty, and we went to state both my junior and senior year. But when we got there, we exactly didn't do too well, so we got beat first round. But we had some good teams back then, and Corson C, it would have been in 1956. You know, the Bulldogs this year got beat the boys, and you know as well as I do, it's probably one of the best teams around, but you know that happens sometimes. But anyway, the Portis Tigers in 1956 was 21-0. Of course, that's when they played little schools. There was two tournaments you had to play to get state.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think they were 21-0 or 22-0 and got beat in the finals of the last round. And I can't remember whether it seemed like it was Green or somebody up in that area, up in north central and northeast Kansas, mm-hmm. that guy should upset them. So that happened. So we're still struggling a little bit with getting beat there. And you know as well as I did, we had a heck of a team. And but that happened, you know. Just because you got some material, you got to have some luck and you got to have some breaks. And they had one of those games that you want to forget, and that's all it takes, by golly.
Yeah. So you, again, at Portis, and then I read where, you know, you kind of enjoyed that experience at state and kind of had made your mind up that from there you kind of wanted to have a chance to help other kids have those kind of experiences, right?
That's exactly right. I did. You know, Portis didn't have football or anything like that, and so basketball was, and we did play baseball. We had some pretty good baseball teams through the years. But anyway, in basketball, we, you know, that was about the Portis blood. Everybody used to collect in the Walters Lumber Company there right on Main Street. You go by that. It's kind of a, that's where everybody collected in the old days. And had a wooden stove set in there, and they come in on Saturdays and mornings and talk the ball games over, and so it was life and blood, and didn't take me too long to realize that you know that was about all there was to do in Portis. So Dad put up a gold, and you know I spent hours and shooting and got pretty good at it, but you know how it is, there's always people better, and I didn't go to college or anything to play sports. I had a scholarship offered to in Iowa. I think it was some junior college back then, but I didn't want to go that far from home. So, of course, I just went to Fort Hays State.
Got the education degree there and the coaching, and looked like you went out to Utica right after that. I'm from Waukini, so you weren't too far south of where the farm was there. So you did a lot in Utica, didn't you? You coached a lot in Utica, didn't you?
Yeah, I was there 6 years, by golly, and it was a great experience for me. In 1965, I started at Utica. Got $5,000 a year. I coached all the boys, all the girls, junior high, high school, and everything there was. And, in fact, the interesting thing, you know, how you did in those old days, you know, you end up on first thing I had to teach was geography, and you know I don't know if I'd even ever had a geography class in my life. I've hardly been out of state of Kansas, and I ended up teaching that for one class. I can't remember that, but it was a great experience. We had some good teams there, and Dave Burrell, he was a heck of a player. He graduated in 71, so I started him and Kirk Foster. Foster played at Kansas Wesleyan. And Dave Burrell went to Barton County, and I think he was all conference or got some honors of some kind there. So, you know, we had a some great kids. Depth-wise, when those little schools, of course, was the problem. And there was a town called McCracken that used to have a heck of a, and they, you know, year after year, and they was always in our league, and we could just never get by them to, you know, get to the state or anything. But back to what you asked me there earlier, you know, I always dreamed getting back to the state because that was probably the highlight of my whole high school. And you know, I always dreamed getting the kids back and so they could be rewarded for you know, what they have done. And so, but anyway, it was a, Utica was a great place to start. And, you know, I come out of high school, took college classes and so forth and physical education, whatever. But, you know, as far as teaching you how to coach, you know, I used a lot of the same methods in my high school. We kind of had a run gun type offense. And so that's kind of what I did. But I did develop our defense. I realized that defense was pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
In 1959, we played Esben in the finals of the regional, I guess it was called then, or district, I guess that's what it was called.
Okay.
And our final game in that was 93-89. So you can see there wasn't too much defense stress back in those years. And so, but finally I got smart enough to figure the defense was important too.
Yeah. So you had some years there in Utica, and then not long after that, you moved just a little bit northwest to Gove County, and we're at Wheatland, right?
Yes, that's right. I moved to, in 71, I went to Greenfield, and that was right pretty much after they, I think maybe they consolidated mid-60s or something, Gove Park and Greenfield. And as far as success, I didn't have near as much success there as I did at Wheatland. You know, they were still about Gove, and Gove was concerned about their players, and Greenfield was concerned about theirs, and it was a tough deal, by golly. But finally, you know, we won a lot of games, but we just weren't very successful, to be right truthful with you there. But it was a great school. I don't know, have you ever been in that school, Dustin?
Oh, I played at Trigo in high school. We played them pretty much every year. Yeah.
I always thought that was the neatest school building I ever seen. You know, the classrooms got stadium seats, you know, like they go up, you know, several layers right in the classroom, and everybody's looking right down on you, and it was a great teaching environment, and it was a great school. It was the best school in the country at that time around.
Yeah, you had some time there in Greenfield, and it sounds like you came back after that, back to Osborne County. It took a little bit of time to get back into teaching because there weren't any positions available yet for you.
When I left there, I looked around, and, you know, I wanted to get back closer to home, and there wasn't any really openings around here. So I worked at Ken's department store. He hired me as manager. He had a clothing store at Plainville also. And so sometimes I'd run back and forth. And so I worked there 3 years, and then 2 years, last two, I ran a jewelry store, or Jamie Roskelly owned it, and he couldn't find anybody, and I wasn't much of a jeweler, but I took some classes and so forth. But for the last 2 years, I was always wanting to get back in teaching. You know, I remember on Saturdays, that was back when Osborne streets, they were open on Saturday nights, and there I was sitting in there, or standing in there in this department store, and other people were out running around, and I thought, man, that teaching must have been a lot better than I thought it was. And so I'd wanted to get back in teaching, but there just wasn't anything available. And so finally in 1981, a job came open, and that's when I started teaching, and I taught it junior high at Alton. And so Kenny Ubelaker and I, we drive every morning, about leave Osborne about 7:30 and head for Alton. I think we taught there about 20 years. And so that's kind of how I finally got back into teaching and coaching part.
And we're talking with Darrell Walters, longtime coach and teacher here in Osborne County, and Alton and Osborne. Go through now, because you didn't start coaching girls basketball right away. You had some other things that you coached there at Osborne. I know you're golf coach for 19 years and had some success there. And you know, late 80s is when you actually got into the girls basketball. But what were some of the things that you helped with as far as the coaching was concerned at the start of your career there at Osborne?
Well, I assisted, I think, most of the time I was there in those 20 years. Of course, I taught in, let's see, I think I started in 87 to 91, 4 years. I coached the high school girls. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I'd just drive back and forth, you know, from Alton to make that happen. But it was a, we taught there at the junior high in Alton for several years, and I assisted Kenny Eam boys maybe 2 or 3 years, and Tammy Schultz was the girls' coach, and I assisted her several years. I assisted on football. Portis never did play football. We didn't have football here. In the teens, a guy, Dan Brumbaugh was his name, he got hurt playing football. In fact, he didn't get hurt here. He went to college and played somewhere back east. And he had a really severe case, and it affected him forever. And so Portis did away with football. You know, I guess they thought it wasn't the risk of getting somebody hurt. So anyway, I helped Kenny with football at junior high, and I didn't know much about it, but he gave me the orders what to do, and so I helped out a little there. So I just filled in wherever they kind of needed me, Jesse.
Yeah, so then really the success came in the late 90s and into the early 2000s with the girls' basketball team, and I know that you attribute a lot of that to the girls that played for you, and I know that Coach Jamie Walters was your assistant there for that time during that success as well. Just as a whole, and we'll kind of talk maybe about some of the individual years, but what was that experience like from building that, starting in 97, to being able to win some state championships there at the end of it?
Well, it was a dream come true for me, really. I just never had expected, you know. I was always one that, you know, went to all kinds of basketball clinics through the years. And, you know, I knew that there was a lot that I didn't know about it. And, of course, there still is a lot that I don't. But I went to all clinics and read all the books. Of course, it wasn't social media. It wasn't internet back in those days. But I learned all I could. And, you know, it was over a period of time, you know, hopefully I got a little bit better and understood the game a little bit better. But, yeah, I started again in 97, and it was, you know, and the way that started was I coached there in the late 80s and early 90s. And so they needed a coach, and it was, I think, basically Mark Roadhouse, maybe Dietz and Ubelaker. Anyway, they asked me if I would be interested in coming back, and, you know, I really hadn't thought much about it.
Mm-hmm.
I finally said I would, and, of course, that was the best, best thing that ever happened to me as far as basketball success is. And I had a tremendous amount of girls, you know, early there. They was, and it wasn't just the what we call the, you know, we've heard of the Roadhouses and the Dietzes and the and Ubelakers and all them. But, you know, what I was most proud of, I think, is the, you know, the ones, somebody's got to throw them the ball. Somebody's got to be unselfish and be able to, you know, take, run the game. And we had some tremendous kids that, you know, accepted that. I don't know if they really liked it. You know, my coaching philosophy was a little bit different than a lot of people's in the fact that, you know, I believe that your best player should get most of the shots. And some people say, well, that's selfish, or that's, you know, that's not team ball. But it sure was, because, you know, it even took more teamwork, because you had to have those people that were willing not to be high scorers that could get the assists and make the passes and play defense. And And I had a tremendous group of kids like that that, you know, didn't get mentioned much, but they were why we were successful. And nowadays, you know, it seems like coaching is everybody's, you know, concerned about their own kids. And, yeah, everybody'd like to start and all this. And I got my share of criticism and all that stuff, but there was kind of a pecking order as far as, you know, who I wanted to shooting the ball and who I wanted to have the hands, ball in the hands of in the tight games. And but it worked out really great, and they bought into what I believed. And so it was the start of something great. That first group, that 97, 98, I think we'd win the state, sure as the world that year, but Carly Tebow. She blew her knee out right after Christmas, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was one of our best players, and we still made quite a run. I think we can even, in that 98 year, I think we went in overtime, you know, and got beat, I think, one point finally. I can't even remember for sure who that was, but it was the start of something great. Those girls were the ones that, you know, got us started.
It's interesting that you talk about it. So you started in 97. That was my freshman year of high school at Trigo. And
really?
I know my classmates didn't like playing against your teams. I can tell you that much. But I think they got you one year, like, not long after I graduated, and it was a big deal, you know. And it's like, but that's where I wanted to go with that, because you built such a big thing there in Osburn. You know, you talked about the 97-98 team, and then in 99, you do win your first trip to state, and you get the one-point loss there. Like I said, Jackson Heights, I think, there's is who you lost to there. But then after 99, you go 2000, and that was just a dream come true for you, wasn't it? A 26-0 year, and you get your first state championship.
Yes, that's the truth. I'll never forget when that game was over, standing there in Bramlage Coliseum, looking up there at the clock, and you know, it was just almost unbelievable, not only the undefeated team, but the fact that somebody from a little town, Portis, that, you know, probably didn't know half what some of those other coaches did or whatever, but there we were, state champions, and, you know, it's just something I'd always dreamed about. And finally, you know, my dream, I finally found some. I've told many a teams that I've had over the years, I said, if you ever get as crazy about basketball as I am, I said, we'll do some good. We'll get to the state. And, you know, we had some, maybe possibly, that was good enough to do that, but probably poor coaching and whatever else. But finally, this group, you know, they were unbelievable. They'd go lift weights. This is just honestly the routine, how dedicated these kids were. They'd go lift weights at 6:30 in the morning. They'd lift them for 30 minutes. Of course, that was back when kids, you know, coaches couldn't help in the summer mm-hmm. or anything like they can now. But anyway, then they'd go shoot in the park or wherever for an hour, hour and a half. So they'd spend their first two every summer, every day, every summer, except, of course, on Sundays. But they were just, they couldn't get enough. Our practices were anywhere from 2 to 3 hours, at least usually 2.5 hours. And, you know, then they'd stay and shoot till 7 o'clock in the evening. And, you know, they'd work on the trays. Of course, it wasn't, we didn't count them back then. But, well, I guess we did, the more I get to thinking mm-hmm. about. But anyway, they were, and, you know, I pushed them a lot, and I just tried, you know, to get the most out of them, you know. And but when you're undefeated, and I believe that was a year that I think 7 points was the closest that anybody got to us all year long. And so it was a, you know, it was an eye opener for sure. And you know, and some people say, well, what was your most exciting, you know, time? And I would say that probably was it, for the fact that it was my first time winning the state. And, mm-hmm. and I think first round we beat Valley Heights.
Mm-hmm.
I think we doubled the score on them about. And in the second round we beat Inman, and that's Inman defensive record still is in the state book. We beat them 51-22, held them to 22 points. And or at least it was a year or two ago. I've kind of lost track.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that was in 2001, wasn't it, Dusty?
Yeah. 2000 was
the year we beat Lori Kane.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
We held her down to 34 points. So we thought
yeah.
we thought we did good. You know, not really, but anyway, we beat them in semis. I think we beat Garden Plain, if I remember right.
Yep.
And, yeah. And then. But anyway, it was just, you know, our defense was stifling, and, you know, they all had motors. They could run up and down that court, you know, and make most people tired. And it was just the start. And you know as well as I do that if you get something going, you know, our fan base was tremendous.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody was excited, and you get that going, you know, the kids, grade school, junior high, they see that and they want to be a part of it too. So that was kind of the start of many things, good things to happen.
So you did mention a little bit there, 2001, so that was when you beat him in there in the second round of the state tournament. But you had a 51-game winning streak that got snapped by Garden Plain in the championship game that year there when you went back to the state championship and fell to them. But how much more pressure did you see? Like, how much did you feel like teams were starting to gun for you and giving you their best shot just as that built up, and then you were able to get a 51-game winning streak and just fell just short there in the championship?
Yeah, it was. You know, we tried to act like it wasn't, we talked like it wasn't, but I'm sure it was. That was the year that also, if I remember correctly, we played three games in a row. You know, it was Thursday, Friday, and Saturday state games. We liked press, and, you know, that's part of my fault. And, you know, you got three games, but, you know, I was worried about the one we was playing at the time. And we pressed, and, you know, and I think really our legs just were gone. We just a step behind, and we'd never, you know, in that 2001, we just never, you know, did regroup, and they beat us, I think, 57-45, if I remember right, the score. So they just outplayed us that game, but yeah, it was really heartbreaking because we, you know, had a good team again next year and could have kept that going. But, you know, I guess that brings up Clapham this year. It's hard to believe, but the run that they're on, how were they, 130-something now?
Yeah, it's 135, I think, is what it last was.
I think it is, too. Yeah. And, you know, it's just, it that's amazing. But anyway, it was a great winning streak, and kids, you know, felt like we'd, even though we got second in the state, felt like we hadn't done anything, but, we did, and you just got to give credit to Garden Plain.
So 2002, though, you come back and you made it back to state and then played Shaley Lenning in the second round. So Blett had a long winning streak after that, after you beat them. They might have started that one up, but you beat them in the second round there and came back with a big win over Ness City in the championship. How exciting was it to get back on the pinnacle and be on the top again in 2002 with that group?
Well, it was really exciting for the kids and me, too, as far as that's concerned. But, that was a great finals, you know. Beating Shailene, you know, she was a whale of a ball player and went on to prove it, by golly. And I think we beat them semis. We beat Sublette, and finals were Ness City. And what kind of was ironic about that is, of course, I taught at Utica, and Foster was her name. Kirk Foster played for me at Utica. And so they went to school at Ness City now. And so we had some good times and good talks. And he was one of the good ball players for me. As I said, played at Kansas Westland. And so kind of extra exciting to beat his gal. I think was about 6'2". She was a post player, really good. And so it was nice to beat her. And, of course, it was nice to beat Sublette, too. But anyway, that I think the only game we lost in 2002 was to Smith Center. We split with them. They beat us one game. And so I think that was the only loss we had that year.
So, 2002, you get the championship, and then you make it back to the state tournament and the state championship then the next year in 2003. Played a Mound Ridge team in the title game that year, and they got you pretty good in that one. But a 98-6 record for that senior class throughout that stretch. How much do you appreciate and go back and reminisce with the girls about that unbelievable stretch you guys had in that time?
Yeah, it was. But I give credit to the kids, you know, and the parents, you know. I had parents who pushed their kids, and, you know, sometimes that's kind of a subject that's a bit sore. Some people think they push your kids too much and they'll want to quit or want to do, but whatever they did was, you know, they didn't. They still loved the game, and, you know, they played in the summer league. That was kind of before too much summer stuff was going on, and but, you know, they played in all them, and some of the parents were real good to make sure they, you know, were playing all summer. And so it was a great to get there again. Was I think if I remember Right. We lost to Wakanda the first game of the season. I think we got beat 1 point, 59-60, I believe it was. And then we went ahead and we ended up 23-3 that year. But I remember in sub-state we beat Sacred Heart. I think it was a 3-point game. And then we later in the state, you know, we Uniontown, I think we beat them. And then we went to beat St. John's and lost to Mound Ridge in the finals pretty easily. We didn't, but they had a, you know, heck of a team too. And so, yeah, that was quite a run. And it just, you know, it was something that I, as I told you before, you know, I tried my best to educate myself, and I'd get up middle night and think of a play, you know, maybe would work. And my wife thought I was crazy, and I was. Anyway, you know, it was all worth it. And usually that play, by the way, that I got up middle night, when I got out on the floor, I seen it wasn't going to work, you know, in your dreams and whatever. Everything worked so good. And so it was kind of, but yeah, it was a great, great run. There's no doubt about it. Then in 2004, I really felt we should have, we got beat. Let's see, with Minneapolis, Ben and Nar. Can't think who, we had a tournament there at Osborne, and we got beat right in the last second shot. And they had the ball, and I think they called timeout, and Gal fell away on the baseline. It went through and beat us, but I think we had enough material. We probably should have went that year, and of course that was disappointing since we'd had so many, and that's when I'd made up my mind that I'm going to see if I can get another state start over, and then, of course, we did again in 2007, last year.
Yeah, again, we're talking with Darryl Walters, former coach of the Osborne Lady Bulldogs, longtime coach. Take me through that last, that was your last year, like you said, and you took them to the state, and you got third place. You know, a different group of girls, a different names, really, than what we saw the first time around, and got to have somebody else experience that, didn't you?
Yes, it really was. You know, that was a, you know, I didn't know whether we'd be good enough to get there or not, but we did. We ended up 23-3 that year, too. And I remember, I think we beat Frankfort in the sub-state finals, I believe, 58-47. And we were the MCL champs, and we won the MCL six times in those stretch of years. And so, you know, everything just fell into place. The Schultz girl was, you know, our outstanding player we had that year. We had a lot of kids that really stepped up and you know, were the difference. And it was so great to get back. And, yeah, we did get beaten. Second round, lost to Oakley. I think it was 50, yeah, I got that written here.
Yeah,
52-46. Or 46-52, we lost. And then we turned around in the finals and played Cimarron, and we beat them, I think, by 8 or 9 points. And so it ended up being a great, you know, I said, it's time for the younger generation to take over, and I think they could get back another year or two after I retired. I can't remember for sure when that was. But anyway, Dusty, it was a great, it just more than I deserved, I can tell you that.
We talked a lot about the, you know, you mentioned some of the names and some of the success that they had. You know, you had Brooke go on to Washburn and have a lot of success, and April and Amber went on as well, Roadhouses. How fun was it to see them move on to the next level and have success there as well?
Well, it was great, you know. I would say that, you know, that's one thing I realized. When I was coaching, I had these good girls, and, you know, it wasn't going to be my fault if they didn't get better. And so, you know, everybody, I remember when I used to go to clinics, the emphasis was always on what they call KISS, you know, was keep it simple, stupid. And, you know, that was what a lot of them preached. Well, I realized I've been in a lot of games, and I wanted to play that I thought would get me 2 points in a critical. So we ran what we called a lot of sets. They really weren't plays, but they were just a couple pass play. And you know, if the defense absolutely don't know what you're going to do and you run that quick, you're going to be able to get that shot. And we pushed those, and, you know, and then we used our good players, you know, when you got somebody can shoot like Uberlaker.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she could, we could just about, we had, I think, 30-some sets that we ran. And, you know, that always ended up getting us at least a look at what we kind of wanted. And so, and same way with passing, you know, the fundamentals say that, you know, good chest passes, well, that's fine. But against good teams, and if you're going to play college ball, you know, chest passes is fine, but that isn't going to get you to the big time. And so, you know, we worked on all kinds of different passes, hook passes, and things that most people probably wouldn't push themselves. And of course, we were always stress defenses, something that we played man-to-man. It was a switching man-to-man difference that most people played. And I can't remember who the coach at Wichita State was way back in the 70s and 80s, but I heard him one time say, you cannot have complete pressure, full court pressure, if you don't switch, you know, mm-hmm. when you're playing man-to-man, because if somebody sets a good screen, they're going to be open at least for a second or two until, you know, the man recovers, defensive man mm-hmm. recovers. And so, you know, on screens, you know, we just jump out and set. They couldn't go the direction they wanted to go. And so basically we had pressure on the ball all the time, even at half court in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, again, thought that was crazy. Say, why would you guard somebody 30 feet from the basket? And, you know, there's some good thinking on that part. But my philosophy was, every time that ball bounces, I want somebody ahead on the ball, and I want somebody to give a chance to get a turnover. And, you know, those kids bought into that, and we had some quickness, no doubt about it, which you got to have if you're going to play good man defense. And, but we worked on that, and what I guess I'm saying for these good girls, you know, yeah, Uberlecker went ahead to she was an All-American, you know. They won the Nationals at Washburn. April was the point guard. So mm-hmm. you know how good those two were. I remember we used to go to the league there at Bloy. And I can't remember what nights it was on. But anyway, I remember people would come to watch April. You know, she was a good ball handler and really quick, you know, and fast. And I can remember people coming to those practices, or those games, they were just inner city
mm-hmm.
leagues they had there for years, and not, maybe they still got them there. Do they still have that?
Yeah, they still have summer stuff, yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
But anyway, people come to watch her, you know, and so those two were, they were just exceptional players, you know, and but they went ahead to win the Nationals, so, you know, they was pretty good. And I think April won it, got All-American for defense too,
because
she was the one we usually put on the best player they had, and we expected her to not allow her to do what she wanted to any time during the game, and she usually could. So we got against Kane and Lenny
yep.
and some of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's been fun to reminisce about some of these times. Like I said, I was in high school through all of it, and I just remember watching the games and seeing how good these teams were. And then I got to experience a little bit of it right when I moved out here as well. So it's been kind of fun to go back over that. What, I know you still go to basketball games. You just follow the grandkids now, aren't you?
Yes, yeah. That's true. I really did, and I still enjoy that, you know. But I have learned to perspective that it is a ball game, and you know, at a time I almost think it was I probably put too much pressure on some of the kids, because you know, there's a lot of things, or at least a couple things, family and God, that should come ahead of basketball. But it worked for me, I guess, and you know, I think basically I think defense is where you can win more games than anything, even if you don't have much material. But, you know, if you're going to play back and let them do what they want to do, it just don't make sense to me. So we like to pressure them. I remember when I was in high school, the ones I hated playing with was somebody really good defensive player, and every time I tried to dribble, he was right there and hand digging and all that. And so that's what I tried to incorporate in my philosophy, at least. And we seem to have some success with that, Dusty.
Darryl Walters, longtime head coach of the Osborne Lady Bulldogs, had a lot of success. Darryl, we certainly thank you for taking the time to visit with us and reminisce about your career, and hope everybody stays happy and healthy, and we'll chat with you down the road, all right?
I appreciate that and appreciate what all you guys do. And yes, I got a lot of time to reminisce now, and some days I can't hardly remember my grandkid's name, but I never forget all those great basketball moments and the excitement and what it did for Osborne and the support I got from the school. And it was I was very blessed. That's just all I can say on it. Dusty, I really appreciate all you guys do, and you've always been a big supporter of Osborne Bulldogs, and guys do a good job, and Wade does too. And so thanks a lot for thinking that I was worth interviewing.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or sunflowerstateradio.com.